could spend quite a lot of time discussing the validity of the terms theosophical concepts. What is a theosophical concept? But I'm not going to spend time on that because it suggests a crystallized certainty as to what theosophy is, and I don't propose to speak in those terms. But rather, I'm going to refer to those concepts which appear to run like threads through all our, in inverted commas, theosophical literature, and appear to be found in the ancient tradition from which our literature stems. I feel that at some point it would be appropriate to tell the apocryphal story of the gentleman who was trying to lay claims for the validity of his own brand of Christianity by assuring his opponents in the argument that Jesus must have been a Christian because his mother was a Roman Catholic. There is a tendency to lay claim to the possession of truth, even if we are not dogmatic about it, and in referring to theosophical concepts in current thought, there is a permanent danger of attributing ideas which I hold or which we hold to other persons. That is to say, to read our thoughts into their writings. That is a permanent danger. We tend to find what we are looking for. And since some of us tend always to be looking for theosophical ideas, it is not surprising that we find theosophical ideas. So perhaps I should prefix the remarks that I'm going to make this morning by saying, please do not identify any name that I mention or any work to which I refer with the theosophical movement regarded as membership of our Theosophical Society. I am going to refer in particular to three ideas which we regard as theosophical, both because of their association with the literature that we know and because we seem to find them in that ancient tradition from which our modern theosophy is derived. Those three ideas are relating to man in different ways. First, the nature of man, what man is, and the way in which he shares the divine life. Secondly, the work for man, what it is we are here for, what we should be trying to do. And thirdly, the goal for man, which is in some form or another the transcendence of separateness. I regard that the realization of the unity which is a fact in nature is somehow that point towards which all evolution is converging. So may I go over those three points once more. The nature of man, the task for man, and the goal ahead of man. My sources are as varied as I could make them in the time that we have before us this morning. We have a Roman Catholic Trappist monk. We have the Dean of St. Paul's. We have Huxley. We have psychologists, psychiatrists, an American sociologist. I would almost add an Uncle Tom Cobley and all. And if we haven't Uncle Tom Cobley and all, it is simply because there will not be time to refer to other sources. But I must reiterate, please do not associate these names with theosophy narrowly conceived. If what these people say is true, it is true on its own merits, in its own right, because it is true. So first, with regard to the nature of man, and again, two or three of the passages which I shall read are ones which I often read in my wanderings around the country, so some of you will have heard them before. I make no apology, they are fine passages, and they deserve being well known and understood. The first is from Professor Mottram, who is professor of, or has been, a professor of physiology in different universities, and has all his scientific facts with regard to human physical constitution, genes, chromosomes, and the rest of it, very well at his fingertips. And he discusses the problem of the physical basis of personality, and having established to his own satisfaction that man's personality is largely accounted for in terms of hereditary factors and environmental factors, he then says, well, is this the conclusion that we must accept, that the basis of our personality is, in a sense, beyond our control? And so he comes to his last chapter, in which, side by side with his scientific findings, he has to discuss, he finds himself compelled to discuss the experiences of mystics throughout the ages. And he starts on quite a different theme, until he himself is forced to the conclusion that there is something other that can be called I, beneath or within that I which we know as our everyday selves. So we come to his very last paragraph. I throw out the suggestion, says Professor Mottram, that the real I, the core of our being, that thing so alien from the everyday I, that is the I which we see in the glass every morning, the I which we regard as ourselves and which has testimonials written about it every now and then and so on, that I, the core of our being, is a spark, an atom of the fundamental reality in the universe. A spark, an atom of the fundamental reality in the universe. But that its activities, what it does, the way in which it behaves and so on, its activities are conditioned, molded, and determined by inheritance and nurture. That is, that threefold personality, which we are accustomed to talking about either in English or Sanskrit, that threefold personality is conditioned, is largely attributed to hereditary and environmental factors. But within that, there is something other which is derived from the fundamental reality of the universe. And as long as we submit ourselves to the conditioning, then we are determined, we move about like trams, on tram lines, the tram lines set for us by these conditioning factors. But when we identify ourselves with that which is within, then we are free, then we are liberated from the hampering effects, the hampering controls of heredity and environment. Incidentally, I would like to mention here that looking at a penguin exhibition the other day in London, a very dangerous thing to do because one tends to buy a book because it is cheap, whether one really has time to read it or not. And I find that there is a new edition. The penguin people have brought out one of the new glossy editions of The Physical Basis of Personality, and it carries an epilogue. Professor Mottram has added an epilogue, in which he refers, curiously enough, to a number of the modern systems which have developed, which have established cults, if you like, in the Western world, and he seems to indicate his allegiance to one of these systems. I will not mention which one, but you may find out for yourselves. Next, we have the Trappist monk. Now, much of the book is written in terms of Roman Catholic theology and may not be acceptable to people who are not familiar with their language or may be unacceptable to people who know the language and have rejected it because they do not like the ideas associated with it. In spite of that, there are certain passages which I find bear no other interpretation than the one which I think you will receive from the words. I bought the book because of its title. Some of you will have heard me lecture to the title, Man, Who Are You? No. Why Were You Born? Why Were You Born? And I'm always interested in a question of what is man? What are you? And I find that people are interested to explore themselves and to learn more. So I bought You by Father Raymond, an American Trappist. And it tells you on the cover that this book will give you the complete and surprising answer to the question, who are you? Well, who would not buy a book with that on the outside? The complete and surprising answer to the question, who are you? I made sure that the book was worth buying by having a good read in the shop before I bought it. But having turned to the last page, I really did not hesitate. First, he said, the best brief reply ever given to the question, who are you, came from human reason illumined by faith. And he refers to the Greeks and then says, in English the answer means, I am a son of God. Then he goes on. Know thyself, and you will arrive at the thrilling knowledge that Y-O-U spells God. That is true not only in the alphabet of the theologian, but also in the alphabet of the philosopher. Y-O-U must spell God in your alphabet if your days and nights are to be anything more than the passing of time. Know thyself. Know that Y-O-U spells God. Know thyself, and you will come to some knowledge of the infinite. And then, right at the end, the sentence which caused me to buy the book, be patient, but above all, be yourself, that is, Christ. Next, a book which has been reviewed in our Theosophical Journal at some time, some of you will know it well, The Manifold and the One, by a person from the book at the back, the list of books at the back. It is obvious that she is a very serious student of botany and biology and so on. That is, she has a scientific training, and her book is not easy to read, partly because of that, her constant references both to philosophy and to science. But if one wants a book that is worth studying, here indeed we have one. And you can tell from its title, The Manifold and the One, that the thought is very much in harmony with the kind of things that we discuss. And so, having discussed in several chapters the way in which the One becomes the Many, she points out how this must always remain a mystery. Although we may discuss, we may try to find out, yet the heart of the matter, the heart of that relationship between the one and the many, must remain a mystery. But the fact that the one and the many have this relationship does suggest that man shares the oneness, shares the being of the one. She speaks in particular of mystical union and the way of contemplation. And in order to distinguish that which is genuine mystical experience from that which is pseudo-experience or emotionality, she says that the touchstone by which the pure gold of mystical experience can be distinguished is that in the full experience, awareness reaches inward to the central spark which connects the individual with the suprapersonal whole. And it also reaches outwards to the manifestation of the whole under the form of manyness. The contemplative who has attained this level has won the realization of his own nature as partaking internally of the one, as well as externally of the many. Within, we share the nature of the one. In our outer expression, in the personality, at the personal level, we belong to manyness. We find the same idea, as I said before, it is difficult to select books, but I could refer in particular to the book which frightened me, or which caused me to be frightened the other day, that Dr. True was going to say everything that I wanted to talk about, remember, because this is the book to which she was referring. It is rather a hefty tome, so there must be plenty that I shall not talk about and that she has not covered. Forms and Techniques of Altruistic and Spiritual Growth. We shall come back to this in a moment. But in explaining the title, there are quite a number of words in the title which bear explanation. Professor Sorokin explains, first of all, the meaning of altruistic and then spiritual. And he says this of the word spiritual: the vague term spiritual signifies here a man who succeeds mentally and behaviorally, expressed that is in action, in identifying his true being not only and not so much with his organism and his unconscious and conscious ego-centered mind, not the person who identifies himself with what we should call the personality, with the organism and the unconscious and conscious ego-centered mind, but especially that person who identifies himself with the supra-conscious infinite manifold, transcending man's ego, indescribable by any words and undefinable by any concepts. And then he proceeds to give a list of those names by which the infinite manifold has been named throughout the ages, throughout religions and philosophies and so on. God, Purusha, pure intelligence, the divine nothing, and so on. A whole list of terms. So that spiritual signifies a man who succeeds in identifying himself with that one. Then again, Dr. Gurdon, his book also has been reviewed in our journal, Man, Divine or Social. Dr. Gurdon says in his preface that he owes a great deal to the writings to personal conversations with Kenneth Walker. And I know that many of you know the line of thought which Kenneth Walker takes. So it is not surprising that Dr. Gurdon writes in a similar vein. He refers to two great trends in man, two great ways in which man expresses himself. One is the cosmic urge. Each of these writers, you will notice, finds his own words, his own vocabulary to express what he means. The cosmic urge, and the other, the herd personality urge. One is the unifying tendency, the cosmic urge, and the other is the separating tendency. And with regard to the first, the cosmic urge, he explains what he means by it in this way. The cosmic urge represents the original essence of which we are made. It is indivisible with the universal stream of consciousness and is not incorporated in the strata of egocentric personality. It is something above and beyond the little, the personal self. And so on. Well, that is quite enough on that theme of the nature of man. Next, I must pass on to the work for man, what it is we have to do. And here, perhaps, that work can be simply summarized by saying, to discover what we are and to explore the possibilities of our own nature, to unfold, to exploit the possibilities of the divine life which is in us. First, just a short passage from Karen Horney, who is regarded as a neo-Freudian. I think that is, she was nursed in the Freudian cradle, but she grew out of the Freudian cradle and developed her own form of psychoanalytic theory and technique. And she discusses at the beginning of this, which was almost her last book, I think, Neurosis and Human Growth, she discusses the way in which one's beliefs about man must colour one's interpretation of the phenomena which the psychoanalyst meets. And without going into the other theories which he discusses, she refers to the belief, the third kind of belief, which she herself obviously holds, with regard to the expressions of behaviour in man. And she puts it in this way. Inherent in man are evolutionary constructive forces which urge him to realize his given potentialities. Man, by his very nature and of his own accord, strives toward self-realization. Now, I must, in order not to give the wrong impression of this, point out that the word self is written with a small s, not a capital S, and is obviously not intended in precisely the same way as Mrs. Ransome's book called Self-Realization Through Yoga and Mysticism, because the self of which Mrs. Ransome speaks is obviously the one self and identifiable with the life of God. Here, it does not appear that Dr. Horney makes that identification. She's thinking rather of the person, the complete person. But I refer to her book because it leaves open the way for a continual inward exploration of what we really are. That self-realization is left open. We must realize ourselves. And as we realize ourselves, so we may get to further and further levels of ourselves. And then there are various ways which have been suggested by students of psychology and psychiatry in particular of dealing with the unwanted urges or tendencies in man, those which are destructive or unharmonious, and so on. And she says, we see a better possibility of dealing with destructive forces in ourselves. By that she means better than suppression or using external controls and so on, or even inner controls. And she says that her better possibility, the better possibility that she perceives, is that of actually outgrowing them, outgrowing those tendencies which are destructive or limiting. The way towards this goal is an ever-increasing awareness and understanding of ourselves. And so self-knowledge is not an aim in itself, but a means of liberating the forces of spontaneous growth. Now, there is a great deal there the book will appeal particularly to those who are interested in psychology, but it is just one example of the way in which one finds in psychological thought certain suggestions that there is an undercurrent of life, a depth to life, which we can tap. In the book list, I was interested to notice, because I always look at the list of references to see the sources from which a writer derives his information, and for one chapter, there is a reference to some of Krishnamurti's talks. That is the only reference which I could identify, other than purely psychological writings, and it may interest you to know that. Next, Julian Huxley. Now, I always talk about Julian Huxley, wisely or unwisely, and I see with pleasure that there are several copies left of The Destiny of Man, which I spoke about at convention. I hope that any copies that there are will go, someone will find them worth acquiring, because there is so much here with regard to the future of man and the work that he has to do. First, I'm going to refer to Evolution in Action, which dates from 1953. It was published. Much of the material is repeated in a shorter form. The essence of it is repeated in The Destiny of Man, in those articles which he wrote for the Sunday Times. A point which he has been making for at least 20 years is that man appears to be the sole agent of evolutionary advance, that all major trends in evolution have come to an end except for the psychosocial. That is, those trends which belong to the non-physical life, the life of the mind, if you like. And then the purpose of society is to nourish the individual, to enable the individual to realize himself. There is always this problem of the relationship of society to the individual and the individual to society. And as a result of his studies, he has led to this conclusion that society exists for the individual, not the other way around, in order that each individual may reach his own fulfillment. And it follows that the individual has a duty to himself, although, of course, he has a duty to society. And this duty to himself is the duty to realize himself, to fulfill his possibilities. In other words, to do some work. That is each person's responsibility. To do that responsibility, to do that work which will express his own powers, to develop his own powers, to use his talents. It is true that one aspect of his fulfillment lies in working for others, but another aspect consists in his enjoyments and the free exercise of his capacities. Here we will hark back, I'm sure, those of us who have been here the whole time, to our discussions earlier in the week when several people reiterated the point that the scientist, the genuine scientist, is not exclusively a scientist. He may also be a musician and a philosopher and a man of letters and a painter and so on. For after all, it is only through human individuals that the evolutionary process reaches its highest and most varied achievements. And now, each time you enjoy a sunset or a symphony, each time you understand an interesting fact or idea, each time you find satisfaction in making something, or in disciplined activity like sport, evolution has brought another of its possibilities to fruition. And therefore you are justified in sitting through a lot of theosophical lectures and attempting to understand them. Because every time you grasp something, every time you make an effort to use your mental powers to seize a new idea, evolution has in you brought another of its possibilities to fruition. And then he goes on. Of course, the possibilities of man's inner life are as important as those of his active existence. And it is that idea which is developed further in the destiny of man. Oh, but perhaps, I must not leave this before I give you that passage which I find very fine. One obvious task for the free world to undertake is the scientific exploration of human possibilities. The scientific exploration of human possibilities. This has, of course, begun, to take the two examples, in the study of educational methods and of psychological capacities. We have applied scientific techniques to the study of the capacities, particularly in children, in terms of IQ tests and so on. But that is not all. The greatest opportunities would seem to lie in applying scientific method to the exploration of man's inner life. The experiences of the mystics of all creeds and of the practitioners of yoga prove what transcendent states of inner peace and unity of spirit the human personality is capable of. I'm going to repeat that sentence. The experiences of the mystics of all creeds and of the practitioners of yoga prove what transcendent states of inner peace and unity of spirit the human personality is capable of. And now, in The Destiny of Man, he goes over the same theme, that it is man's destiny to lead evolutionary advance, to take responsibility for evolutionary advance. And he refers to various ways in which we may do this. He refers, for instance, to the role which education must play, not merely instruction and training, but by the eliciting of possibilities. That is a concept, of course, which many educationalists do hold and have held for quite a long time, but it is still by no means sufficiently understood or sufficiently carried out in practice. The eliciting of possibilities in children rather than feeding with information. It implies that society should be so organized as to provide opportunity for the fulfillment of its individual members through adventure and meditation, through the arts and travel and shared activities. The idea of the welfare state must be supplemented by that of the fulfillment society, a society, a community of humanity in which the community assists the individual to fulfill himself. It implies further the attempt to understand more about man's inner life. How can man resolve psychological conflict? How attain inner peace and spiritual harmony? What is the value of mystical experiences of self-transcendence? Can the techniques of attaining them, like yoga, be readily communicated and learnt? We must follow up all clues to the existence of untapped possibilities like extrasensory perception. It sounds very much like the third object of our society, does it not? We must follow up all clues to the existence of untapped possibilities like extrasensory perception. They may prove to be as important and extraordinary as the once unsuspected electrical properties of matter. And so on and so on. There is much more of it, but I can assure you that this is a treasury of suggestive statements about the future. Next, the goal. This is our third and last theme. The goal for man, which is for evolution, a return to the original oneness which we knew in the beginning. Here perhaps just a short statement from Erich Fromm, The Art of Loving, which I think some of you know. He says, the deepest need of man is the need to overcome his separateness. And that theme we find over and over again emerging. The idea that man, as he is in himself, is separate, suffers from isolation, Dr. Gurdon uses the word apartness. The apartness of man, the isolation of the individual, and so on. And that somehow we must break that down and come to a unity. The deepest need of man is the need to overcome his separateness, to leave the prison of his aloneness. Man, of all ages and cultures, is confronted with the solution of one and the same question, the question of how to overcome separateness, how to achieve union, how to transcend one's own individual life and find at-one-ment. I said I had one passage from the Dean of St. Paul's. This is one of the Saturday sermons in the Daily Telegraph just last month, July the 22nd. Dr. Matthews, Dean of St. Paul's, and his Saturday sermon is called Death of the Self. It is interesting to find that even the language of modern thought has been coloured by no doubt the translations from the East, because we have not, I think, in our upbringing, been accustomed to talk about the self, either in Christian language, either the personal self or the greater self. We have used other words. We have meant the same thing, but we have not used this term, and here it is being used to express Christian ideas. He is discussing two apparently conflicting teachings in Christianity. Whosoever would save his soul shall lose it, and then he that loveth his soul loseth it, and he that hateth his soul in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. And so he says, how can we have this love-hate attitude to ourselves? Is it not a psychological impossibility? And then he goes on to say, the New Testament, in agreement with much spiritual insight in other religions, asserts that we are subject to a dangerous illusion about ourselves, which consists in taking the ordinary self of day-by-day existence as the whole self. Now, that is almost precisely what Professor Mottram said at the end of his book. The illusion of taking the everyday self as though it were the one. And so, in finding a solution to this problem, he says, at the center of ourselves, we are immortal spirits in contact with God. And therefore, the death of the self, that is, the smaller self, the everyday self, is the necessary condition of the salvation of the self. That which is real and permanent will only emerge when we have got rid of the shell. We must break through the barrier of illusion that we may begin to know life, that is life indeed. Now, I feel certain that if we had eliminated one or two specifically Christian references in that and incorporated it theosophical framework, no one would have suspected the source from which it came. We share the same language. We are talking about the same reality. It is by no means the exclusive property of the Theosophical Society. And then, I think to conclude... No, I can't conclude yet. I thought there was something else, only I have already made one reference to each of these books, and I must refer to them here again. That is to Dr. Gurdon, because he seems to have studied very profoundly some of the ways in which our current society, and particularly current educational techniques, prevent us from realizing life as it is. I have already mentioned the two urges which he discerns, the two great streams or directions of life, the cosmic urge which moves us towards the originating oneness, and the herd personality urge, that urge to make ourselves separate, which leads to apartness. And the techniques which life employs in order to achieve these diametrically opposed goals are, in one case, pure perception. And the whole section on pure perception, or direct awareness, seems to me to read just like Krishnamurti. That direct awareness, which it would be incorrect to say bypasses the mind, it is just of a different order from the mind. I can remember in one of his talks, Krishnamurti referred to the mind as, or to mental processes, the screen of evaluating processes. That is, the whole business of thinking about things and forming concepts, forming ideas. And ideational thinking is anathema to Dr. Gurdon. Now, some of us pride ourselves on our minds, on our ability to think. But, he says, ideational thinking, that is, the forming of ideas, seems to be an is an obstruction to the awareness of truth. Truth is not perceived by ideas. They are a barrier to the perception of truth. Pure perception gives us direct awareness. And so he shows how the child, if unspoilt by education, may enjoy that direct awareness. Ideational thinking leads us only to darkness. Men, he says, are separated by their ideas and joined by their feelings and perceptions. Men are separated by their ideas and joined by their feelings and perceptions. And again, the worship of ideas is a substitute for living. The worship of ideas is a substitute for living. He has some very devastating things to say, and in order to give you a little light relief, I think I must refer to one or two passages which you will like. He has a wit which I find delightful. Need for a moment to find this. He is a doctor, of course, a practicing psychiatrist. Referring to the state medical service, he writes, "The doctors of the future are doomed to become ferocious bookworms with a slide rule mentality." That is largely thanks to the National Health Service and so on. "The theologian, perhaps the most thwarted and ambitious of all the scientists, synthesizes God piecemeal from fragments of reassuring dogma and from the harassed deductions of those who combine an absence of religious feeling with a dread of skepticism." I'll work that one out and you'll find. And then I think some of us will appreciate this. "Of the childless woman, she may even exhibit the more tigerish manifestations sometimes associated with the maternal instinct and lend her support to the societies for the suppression of blood sports." In referring to education, he says, "The aim should be not to develop our faculties, and that would surprise many teachers, not to develop our faculties, but to ensure the life in freedom of what underlies and directs them, of what underlies and directs those faculties. And as long as we have specialists in schools, we shall not achieve education. Dare I say this? I will say it again. As long as we have specialists in schools, we will not have education. Because the specialist, this is me, this is, well, I think Dr. Gurdon would say hear, hear, if he were listening. As long as we have specialists, we shall think in terms of subjects and knowledge and information. We shall not think in terms of children and the development of faculty. We shall think in terms of the acquisition of knowledge. That has its place, but only because it is by exploring fields of knowledge that we ensure the life in freedom of what underlies the faculties. But that is a subject for you to pursue. And now I want to come to his reference to psychoanalytical techniques and to the cure of the disturbed personality, which he puts side by side with the techniques for the liberation of the true self. First, he is speaking of the psychology of cure, referring to psychotherapy. The requirements of cure are that the individual should aim at the destruction of his egocentric personality. The destruction of the egocentric personality is the only way to real release of the person. And he can only do this by surrendering it as a whole. Cure can only be achieved by a process of ceasing to cling to, by a process of giving up. Give up thy life if thou wouldst live. He does not quote that, I have put that in. But that in psychotherapy. And then, referring to the cosmic urge, he says, the cosmic urge, the urge to oneness, is essentially not an attacking force. It achieves its effects when the personality is prepared to withdraw. It is by the renunciation or the abandonment of the little self that the greater self is able to manifest. The same mechanism operates in the process of conversion, which involves, in the moment of its inception, a death of the ego as a whole. And if you remember Masefield's poem on the everlasting mercy, it suggested that the death of the ego as a whole, the abandonment of the lesser self, the laying down, to use his words, the laying down of the burden of self. The cosmic urge, like a flash of lightning, illuminates a fissure in the egocentric personality. The sudden effects of total enlightenment and of the laying down of the burden of self can only be explained by the sudden surrender of the personality as a whole. So it is this idea of the giving up, the renunciation of the lesser in order that the greater may express itself. The whole book deserves to be read and studied. And now, in this mighty tome, Forms and Techniques of Altruistic and Spiritual Growth, you will have the opportunity of taking down authors' titles and so on. This is a symposium by Professor Sorokin, who is in charge of that centre, which Dr. True referred to, a research centre in creative altruism. The early history of psychology shows that one of the first interests, in fact, one of the first sources of psychological information was the study of the diseased and the abnormal mind. And there has been, since its beginnings, a growing literature. The earlier literature was extensively based on the disturbed mind, the deformed mind, and the criminal. Because those people happen to be all together in the same place. And therefore, the students of the mind could have access to asylums and to prisons and have a lot of subjects to observe and to write down data about. Geniuses and saints don't tend, except perhaps in summer schools, to congregate together in one place and to subject themselves to answering questionnaires or to filling in forms. And so it has been left to almost the present decade for people to concern themselves with those other tendencies, that is, the tendencies towards sanctity, towards altruistic behavior. People have been concerned for many years with the motivation of the criminal or with the causes of the disturbed mind. But it is only recently that they have concerned themselves here in this research work in America with the causes of altruistic behavior. We have often discussed, and you will have references, magistrates will discuss, what makes a person steal. She may be a countess, occasionally countesses or people with titles do steal from, they find themselves with a packet of tea that they haven't paid for, or some new nylons in their shopping bag. What is it that makes a very respectable person do these things? All right, that is interesting. But what makes a person give to others? What makes a person generous? What makes a person devote his life to others? That is not questioned. It seems to be taken for granted. And so we have this study in America on forms and techniques of altruistic and spiritual growth, because since we recognize that people do devote themselves to others, do live by the light that never was on land or sea, it may be possible, as Huxley suggested, to learn the techniques and to teach the techniques to others, to develop altruistic behavior by positive means. There is some obvious indication, it will not need Sherlock Holmes, I think, to find it, that the book comes from America, because he even has to devise, Professor Sorokin, I think, who is the editor, not the author, of this symposium, to give a name to this study, the Applied Science of Ametology. I suppose ametology means being friendly. I don't know. The book deals with the effective techniques of altruistic and spiritual transformation of men, altruistic and spiritual transformation. And it claims to lay the foundations for a new applied science of ametology as a science of moral and spiritual education and of friendly relationships between persons and groups. And there is an account, which I can't go into, of rather interesting experimental work among students of causing students to get to like fellow students whom they didn't like. Certain students who were prepared to work in this way, to cooperate in the experiment, were invited to name certain other students whom they just didn't like. And then to follow certain advice, certain suggestions, and to watch, to keep a diary of their reactions and of their relationships. And when they followed their instructions and kept their diary carefully over a sufficiently long period of time, they all ended by becoming friendly with the people whom they didn't like. There was a change, I think I'm right in saying, in every case. In other words, attitudes towards our fellow men can be altered. And the alterations were mainly through getting to know the person better. instead of reacting to just one aspect of the personality. But what I'm particularly interested in this book for is that a large proportion of it, since it is devoted to techniques of altruistic and spiritual growth, is devoted to yoga, a study of yoga. There are a great many authors here. They have all contributed one section. And part one, which is the most extensive part, is on the ego-transcending techniques. That is, those techniques which are used for helping us to transcend the little personal self. And of the 13 chapters in that section, 11 are on yoga. And there is a great deal more throughout on the subject of yoga. Perhaps I can just, seeing that I am consuming time, just one or two references to it. It is delightful to read from students of yoga whom we don't normally come across. Their names that I don't know at all. People who have soaked themselves in the great tradition of India and who recognize the greatness of that tradition. The entrance of India and of Oriental traditions in general at one of the most critical moments in the history of the Occident and of the world might well prove someday to have the same importance as the discovery of Greek thought in the Middle Ages. I think that is a significant statement. This entrance of India and of Oriental traditions in general at one of the most critical moments in the history of the Occident and of the world might well prove someday to have the same importance as the discovery of Greek thought in the Middle Ages. And so there is a great deal on the subject of yoga, and I mustn't allow myself much time on this. Just we'll have one sentence. The moment seems to have arrived when we should again take up this science, that is the science of yoga, this science of yesterday and of all time. The moment seems to have arrived when we should again take up this science of yesterday and of all time. Now that seems to say is precisely what Julian Huxley said, that now is the time to turn our attention to the scientific exploration of man's inner possibilities. And that he refers precisely to yoga and mysticism. So there we have a corroboration of that. And lastly, let us refer to Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, The Phenomenon of Man, which you have heard of many times before, and you will hear many times more. I can only choose one idea from the many ideas with which the book is rich, and that is the idea which he calls, his language is a little difficult, mega synthesis, the great synthesis, in which the whole of evolution appears to be uniting. He refers to the way in which the evolutionary process results in multiplication and diversification on the side of form, an increase in the variety of species and so on, but that is followed or accompanied by a unification of life, which is carried to its highest point in man. The more we tend to attempt to diversify by establishing ourselves separately, by having individual ideas, the more we unite. But it is a unity at the mental level, at the psychological level. He gives us, in one very beautiful passage on this synthesis, a summary of the way in which atoms unite to become molecules, molecules to become cells, and this reads just like Dr. Besant's, book? Oh, it's in several of hers, where she refers to this. The atoms become molecules, molecules cells, the cells metazoa, the metazoa combine or lead to the higher organisms, and then we have the emergence of the thinking layer. And he says, ever more complexity on the side of form, ever more complexity, and thus ever more consciousness. the increasing complexity of the form and the greater emergence of consciousness. The outcome of the world, the gates of the future, the entry into the superhuman. The outcome of the world, the gates of the future, the entry into the superhuman, these are not thrown open to a few of the privileged, nor to one chosen people to the exclusion of all others. They will open, this is the gates of the future, will open to an advance of all together in a direction in which all together can join and find completion in a spiritual renovation of the earth.
That concludes this recording from the English section, Summer School. The following is the list of books used by Miss Hoskins for this lecture. Number 1. The Physical Basis of Personality by V. H. Mottram, published by Penguin. The date, 1944. Number 2, You, by the Reverend M. Raymond. Published by Clonmore and Reynolds of Dublin, 1959. Number 3, The Manifold and the One, by Agnes Arbour. Published by John Murray, 1957. Number 4, The Art of Loving, by Erich Fromm. Published by Allen and Unwin, 1957. Number 5, Man Divine or Social, by Arthur Gerdham, published by Vincent, 1960. Number 6, Neurosis and Human Growth, by Karen Horney, published by Routledge and Kegan Paul, 1951. Number 7, Forms and Techniques of Altruistic and Spiritual Growth, edited by Professor Tirim Sorokin, published by the Beacon Press, Boston, United States of America, 1954. Number 8, Evolution in Action, by Julian Huxley, published by Chatto and Windus, 1953, also by Julian Huxley, two essays in The Destiny of Man, published by Hodder, 1959, and finally, number 9, The Phenomenon of Man, by Pierre de Chardin, published by Collins in 1959. This concludes the list of books referred to by Miss Ianthe Hoskins.